So, whether you're prepping for a big manufacturing supply chain meeting later today, or you're just, insanely curious about how the seemingly impossible objects around you are actually made, we have got something incredibly special for you. Welcome to the Deep Dive.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, so our mission for this exploration is to completely map out the magical, almost shape-shifting world of metal injection molding, or as the industry calls it, M.
Right, M.
And to do this properly, we have brought a massive stack of sources to the table today. I mean, we are pulling from highly technical metallurgical research papers on aluminum and stainless steel. We've got industry design guides.
Actual equipment sales quotes.
Yes, exactly. And even some really highly detailed defect analysis reports.
It is a formidable stack of information. And what makes this particular deep dive so compelling to sift through is how it bridges that massive gap between raw, highly complex physical chemistry and the everyday objects you might literally be holding in your hand right now.
Yeah. Before we throw ourselves into the data, though, let's establish what metal injection molding actually is, because honestly, it sounds like a contradiction in terms.
It really does.
Imagine taking the incredible design flexibility of plastic injection molding, where you can quickly create almost any intricate shape you want, and combining that with the sheer strength and durability of traditional machined metal. That is the promise of MUM.
Exactly.
According to our source from CMG Technologies, this process is used for everything from highly critical aerospace components that keep planes in the sky to the tiny, delicate tang buckles on luxury watch straps.
Oh, and they even use it to manufacture Valor bands.
Right. For those who don't know, those are specialized metal castings and links for modular bracelets that allow military personnel to proudly wear their medals every day rather than, just keeping them hidden away in a display box somewhere.
It really is an elegant solution to a very old, very expensive manufacturing problem. Historically, if you wanted to mass produce a tiny, highly complex metal part, your only real option was to take a solid block of expensive steel or titanium and just
Slowly machine it away.
slowly machine it away until you had your shape. You were paying for metal that just ended up as scrap shavings on the factory floor. MEM changes that entire paradigm.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Yeah.
Because the process itself reads like a highly orchestrated science experiment, and understanding the steps is crucial to understanding the chaos that can happen later.
Oh,
There are
absolutely.
four main steps. First, there's mixing, where microscopically fine metal powders are blended with a polymer binder, which is essentially plastic, to create a putty-like substance called the feedstock.
Right.
Then comes the actual injection molding, where this warm metallic putty is shot into a mold to create what the industry calls the green part.
The green part.
Yeah. Step three is debinding, which carefully melts or dissolves that plastic polymer away to leave a highly porous brown part.
And finally, the grand finale.
Sintering, where this fragile shape is blasted in a furnace to just below its melting point.
To give you a mental image of those middle steps, because the terminology can be obscure, think of that green part right out of the mold, like unbaked cookie dough or wet clay.
What clay is a good way to look at it?
It holds the intricate shape perfectly, but it has almost no structural integrity. You could probably snap it with your fingers. Then, once it goes through debrinding and becomes a brown part, it's essentially a metallic sponge.
Full of holes.
It is full of microscopic holes, exactly where the plastic used to be.
And that porous sponge state leads right into the furnace. Which brings us to a detail in the Advanced Powder Products Design Guide that honestly forced me to reread the paragraph three times.
Shrinkage.
Yes. During that final sintering process, as the intense heat causes the metal particles to literally fuse together and close up those microscopic holes, the entire solid part shrinks by 15 to 20%.
What's fascinating here is this shrinkage is absolutely not a flaw.
It's not.
No, it is a highly calculated and necessary feature of the process, but it requires a level of predictive engineering that borders on clairvoyance.
I just can't wrap my head around it. A 20% dimensional shrinkage. You literally have to build the initial steel mold a fifth larger than the final product.
You do.
And you have to somehow calculate exactly how it's going to shrink in three dimensions without warping into a potato chip.
That is the magic of the math behind it. To make that shrinkage work predictably, manufacturers have to adhere to incredibly tight design
I don't know
tolerances,
how tight.
usually keeping deviations between 8.2% and 1% of the final dimension. The design guide stresses that to prevent that potato chip warping you mentioned, you need highly uniform wall thicknesses throughout the entire object. They heavily recommend keeping walls between 0.1 millimeters and 12.5 millimeters.
So no wildly thick sections next to paper-thin ones.
Exactly. You also want to avoid designing sharp, harsh corners, as those create stress points during the shrinking phase. And there's a strict weight limit for this to be effective. The parts generally need to be under 100 grams.
Wow.
If you design a part that is too thick or too heavy, gravity and uneven heat distribution take over. The shrinkage becomes entirely unpredictable, and the part will distort.
So, assuming the design is perfect, we still have to nail the chemistry, the recipe for the feedstock. Because getting that raw metal powder and the plastic binder to play nicely together under immense pressure seems incredibly difficult.
It's arguably the hardest part.
I was reviewing the Zanin research paper provided in our stack, which focuses on magnesium AZ31 alloys. And stepping into this as a layman, my assumption was simple. If I want a stronger metal part right out of the mold, I should obviously just cram more metal powder into the mix, right?
It is the most logical assumption you could make, but the physical chemistry of injection molding is notoriously counterintuitive.
It really is. The researchers tested different powder loadings, meaning the sheer volume of actual metal in the mixture, at 61%, 63%, and 65%.
And what did they find?
The data completely flipped my assumption upside down. It showed that while the 65% metal volume gave the highest overall density, it actually resulted in the lowest grain strength, meaning the unbaked cookie dough version of the part was the weakest when it had the most metal.
It sounds like a paradox until you zoom in and look at the role of the binder.
Right.
By pushing the metal volume all the way up to 65%, they inherently had to decrease the amount of the backbone polymer in the recipe, which in this specific magnesium study was high-density polyethylene, or HDPE.
Which is basically the glue.
That polymer isn't just a vehicle to get the metal into the mold. It is the physical glue that holds the metal powder together when the part is ejected. By starving the mixture of that HDPE, the green part became overly dry, weak, and brittle.
It is a remarkably delicate balancing act. And the relentless pursuit of the perfect recipe doesn't stop at magnesium.
No, it doesn't.
There's another study in our materials by Warda Toljana and her research team focusing on aluminum polypropylene feedstock, abbreviated as LPP. And they were trying to figure out how to optimize the sintering process to get the strongest possible aluminum part.
Yes, and their approach is a brilliant example of modern process optimization. Instead of testing every single possible combination of heat, time, and ingredients, which would take years, they use the Taguchi statistical method.
I saw that referenced. How does that actually work in practice?
Think of it like a highly strategic culinary test kitchen. The Taguchi method uses mathematical arrays to isolate variables.
Okay.
It allows engineers to test a very small, specific handful of formulations and confidently predict which single variable is pulling the most weight. Through this method, they found something surprising. The holding time, meaning the duration the part actually sits baking in the sintering furnace, barely matters at all.
Right?
It only had a negligible 3% effect on the final density of the aluminum part.
So leaving it in the oven longer doesn't make it better. What did work?
Chemistry. They discovered that adding just 2% of tin at 650 degrees Celsius acted as a massive activator.
Just 2%.
That tiny, almost imperceptible addition of tin accounted for a staggering 47% improvement in the part's density. It effectively flowed into and removed the microscopic internal voids that would otherwise severely weaken the final aluminum structure.
And what I loved about that study is that they didn't just eyeball the results or guess the shrinkage. They actually verified the exact volume of these parts using a high-fidelity 3D scanner and an application called Mesh Mixer.
Oh, yeah, the digital verification.
It allowed them to digitally prove that the volumetric shrinkage matched their mathematical models perfectly.
Mm-hmm.
But all of this intricate chemistry, the perfect binders, the pinch of tin, none of it matters if you don't have the heavy machinery to actually force that thick, viscous paste into a tiny mold.
True. It requires an astonishing amount of physical force to push a dense mixture of raw metal and plastic through tiny injection gates before it cools and solidifies.
Which brings us to the actual hardware. We have an industrial sales quote from John Ward at Arsberg detailing the injection molding machines required to pull this off.
Serious machinery.
He recommended their S-machine range. We are talking about massive 77-ton to 110-ton hydraulic machines. They're equipped with highly specialized 20-millimeter screws just to drive the abrasive feedstock forward.
And he outlined their electric technology options too, right?
Yeah. If a manufacturer wants to upgrade, those electric options use direct drives instead of traditional belts, liquid cooling instead of air cooling fans, and planetary drive spindles instead of standard ball screws.
It is a phenomenal feat of mechanical engineering.
Yeah.
And it's worth noting that processing certain materials requires even more specialized equipment.
Like what?
Well, the quote highlights vacuum options. If you're processing tricky reactive metals like titanium, you absolutely need a vacuum environment.
Because of oxygen.
Exactly. Titanium loves to react with oxygen at high temperatures, which makes it brittle. You have to suck all the air out of the system to protect the integrity of the metal.
He also noted that before the raw material even touches the injection machine, you need specialized preparation equipment like the Turbula shaker mixer. Apparently, you need incredibly complex three-dimensional particle motion just to ensure the metal dust and the plastic binder are perfectly uniformly blended.
You can't just stir it with a stick.
No, definitely not. So we have the chemistry and we have the machines to inject it. Let's talk about where the metal actually goes.
The molds themselves, which happen to be the source of one of the most persistent manufacturing dilemmas in this entire industry.
Right, because the molds that go into those massive 110-ton Aarberg machines are typically machined out of hardened steel, like Stavax stainless mold steel.
And Stavax is tough.
It has to be. Given the extreme pressures and the sandpaper-like abrasiveness of the metal feedstock being shot into them, the molds have to be practically indestructible. But machining a complex multi-part cavity into a solid block of hardened steel is brutally expensive, and it takes weeks.
It represents a massive barrier to entry. If you are a company trying to design a new surgical tool, you might need to iterate on the design 5 or 6 times. You simply cannot afford to machine 6 different Stavax steel molds just to test prototypes.
Here's where it gets really interesting, because the research stack offers a brilliant shortcut. The Kuo and Pam paper details a process called rapid tooling technology, or RTT.
RTT.
Instead of slowly cutting solid steel, they developed a mold using an aluminum-filled epoxy resin. Essentially, they cast a high-tech plastic mold to make metal parts.
The economics of this alternative are striking.
Yeah.
When they conducted their cost-benefit analysis, creating the mold using the conventional steel method, which involves painstaking wire cutting, CNC machining, and mirror finish polishing, was vastly more expensive and took about 76 hours of continuous manufacturing time.
That's a long time to wait for one prototype mold.
But pouring and curing that aluminum-filled resin mold, it slashed the financial cost by about 30%, dropping from over 13,000 New Taiwan dollars to just over 9,000. And it dropped the production time down to just 53 hours.
A 30% discount on both time and tooling costs is absolute gold for a manufacturer trying to rush a prototype to market.
It is a massive advantage, but if we connect this to the bigger picture, there is a significant catch that manufacturers have to plan for.
There's always a catch.
Always. A traditional Stavax steel mold has an expected lifespan of about 100,000 violent injection molding cycles. The rapid resin mold, due to the softer nature of epoxy, only lasts for about 1,300 cycles.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that is a mere 1.3% of the steel mold's operational lifespan. The researchers noted that by cycle 1,300, the surface roughness of the resin starts noticeably degrading, and the dimensions of the molded parts begin to warp outside of those tight tolerances we discussed earlier.
So you aren't going to use an epoxy mold to mass produce a million watch buckles.
Certainly not, but it is the perfect, cost-effective shortcut for research and development. It allows engineers to fail fast and iterate cheaply.
That makes sense.
Plus, the researchers discovered that the mechanical properties and heat transfer capabilities of this resin can be strategically improved by doping the mixture with materials like copper powder, zirconia, or molybdenum disulfide.
Which stretches the utility of that rapid mold just a bit further.
Exactly.
It's all about picking the right tool for the specific phase of manufacturing. But let's be realistic here. Even with the absolute best steel molds, the perfect Taguchi-tested chemistry, and million-dollar Aarberg machinery, things in manufacturing go wrong.
All the time.
Our sources include a rather anxiety-inducing defect guide from Sigma. It outlines the nightmares manufacturers constantly fight. Uneven shrinkage, severe porosity, oxide inclusions, dimensional inaccuracy, and flow lines.
Flow lines are a particularly stubborn issue. They often manifest as highly visible dark seams on the surface of the finished part.
Right.
They're usually caused by uneven cooling or the feedstock hesitating as it fills the cavity during injection.
The Kuon pan paper actually brought this up. They used a simulation software called MoldX 3D before they ever poured their mold. And the software correctly predicted that these black lines would form near the mold's gate simply because the powder concentration was mathematically too low in that specific geographic area of the mold.
Software simulation is incredibly powerful now.
It's amazing that it can simulate the flow of metal powder that accurately. But simulating is one thing, finding actual physical defects is another. How do you find a microscopic bubble of void trapped deep inside a solid piece of stainless steel without slicing the part in half and ruining it?
You certainly can't tell just by looking at the polished surface, and you definitely don't want to find out that a void exists when the part catastrophically fails under stress in the real world.
No, that would be bad.
This is where the documentation from LumaField completely changes the diagnostic landscape. They utilize industrial CT scanning.
Wait, CT scanners? Like the massive humming tubes you'd lie in at a hospital if you injured your spine, but for a steel gear?
It is the exact same underlying X-ray technology, just calibrated for industrial density. Instead of physically cutting a part open to inspect it, which obviously destroys the product and slows down production, quality assurance engineers can place a solid metal surgical instrument or a tiny orthodontic bracket into the CT scanner.
And it sees right through it.
The scan provides a comprehensive, highly detailed 3D view of the internal structure.
Imagine being an engineer sitting at a monitor and essentially flying a digital camera through the molecular structure of a solid titanium part.
It's literal non-destructive X-ray vision. It allows them to spot internal porosity, incomplete sintering where the powder didn't fuse, or micro cracks that form during cooling. It takes all the guesswork out of failure investigation.
Incredible. And keeping those internal defects at bay often comes down to tracking and managing an invisible enemy throughout the entire process. Carbon.
Yes. Carbon control is widely considered the most delicate, unforgiving physical chemistry problem in the entire metal injection molding process.
To give you an idea of the lengths the industry goes to monitor this, we have a sales quote in our stack from Sanford for an ON900 analyzer.
A very specialized piece of equipment.
Very. This is a $37,000 piece of equipment.
Mm.
That is the price of a mid-sized sedan. It comes complete with an electrode impulse furnace and highly sensitive infrared cells. And it is used for one highly specific purpose, to check the exact oxygen and nitrogen levels in the metal.
The precision required just to make sure the metal is, for lack of a better word, breathing correctly during production is staggering.
It really is.
It has to be that precise. And to truly understand why that $37,000 machine is necessary, we need to dive into the highly complex decarburization study conducted by Lou and their team on 420 stainless steel.
Right, the 420 stainless study.
420 stainless is heavily relied upon in manufacturing, but it requires extremely accurate carbon control to maintain its legendary hardness and structural integrity. Their study reveals that the loss of carbon during the intense heat of sintering doesn't just happen all at once in a linear fashion.
It's a two-stage process.
Exactly. It occurs in two very distinct stages, separated by a critical temperature threshold of 1200 degrees Celsius.
Okay, walk us through stage one.
Yeah.
What is happening to the metal when the furnace is climbing, but still below that 1200 degree mark?
Below 1200 degrees, the part is still that brown part sponge we talked about earlier.
The highly porous one.
Yes. The interconnected pores are wide open to the atmosphere inside the furnace. At this stage, decarburization, the loss of carbon, happens right at the surface of the individual powder particles. The oxygen in the surface oxides reacts with the residual carbon left over from the plastic binder we melted away.
And because the pores are wide open, the carbon content remains relatively uniformly distributed throughout the part.
Correct.
And from what I understand, losing this specific carbon early on is actually a good thing, right?
It is essential. The reduction of those surface oxides is exactly what allows the raw metal particles to finally touch each other without a barrier. It allows them to form what are called sintering necks, which is the critical metallurgical bonding process that actually gives the metal its solid strength.
But then the furnace hits 1200 degrees Celsius, and the rules of the physics game change entirely.
Drastically. At and above 1200 degrees, the inner regions of the part begin to densify much faster due to the extreme heat. Those interconnected open pores we just talked about, they rapidly close up and seal shut.
I'm picturing baking a loaf of artisan bread. The intense heat causes the outside crust to harden and densify, which seals off the inside of the loaf.
That is a perfect analogy. The outside crust seals. Now, the carbon atoms that are trapped on the inside of the solidifying metal can't just easily react with the open air in the furnace.
Oof, they're locked in.
They must physically migrate or diffuse through the densifying solid metal to reach the surface and react with the atmosphere.
So the surface is rapidly burning off its carbon, but the sealed off inside can't supply new carbon fast enough to replace it.
Precisely. The surface loses carbon much faster than the inside can replenish it. This leaves you with a final, cooled part that has a highly uneven carbon distribution. It has higher carbon trapped on the inside and much lower carbon on the outside shell.
Which is a huge problem.
It is. Because the surface is now starved of carbon, it severely negatively impacts the surface hardness, the fatigue resistance, and the overall mechanical properties of the final part. Managing that delicate carbon migration is the literal difference between a metal part that lasts a lifetime and one that shatters on day one.
So what does this all mean?
If you look at all our highly technical sources together, from the Aarberg machines to the Taguchi statistical models to the decarburization studies, they tell the story of a masterclass in extreme balancing acts.
It really is a balancing act.
Metal injection molding isn't just pouring hot liquid metal into a cast like a blacksmith. These manufacturers are simultaneously juggling the physical chemistry of polymer binders, the extreme thermodynamics of 1,200-degree furnaces, the microscopic behavior of elements like carbon and tin, and the hard economics of rapid resin tooling.
All at the same time.
It is a process that essentially turns a hard metal into a fluid paste, shrinks it by a fifth of its volume, and yields a solid, incredibly complex part with near-perfect tolerances.
It really makes you look at the manufactured world differently. The next time you strap on a luxury watch and click that tiny metal buckle, or you look at a highly specialized surgical instrument, or you see a complex metal component deep in your car's engine, take a second to truly appreciate it. Think about the invisible molecular battles of internal porosity, uniform 20% shrinkage, and microscopic carbon migration that were fought and won by engineers just to create it.
This raises an important question. Throughout this deep dive, we've explored how different plastic binders like polypropylene and high-density polyethylene are used simply as temporary vehicles. They carry the metal powders into the molds before being deliberately burned away and destroyed.
Right, the debinding phase.
We even saw in the Zanin study that actual waste plastic was successfully formulated into their binder.
Oh, that's true.
If the MIM process is already capable of incorporating waste plastic as a temporary sacrificial carrier, could the future of metal manufacturing simultaneously become the ultimate recycling engine for the world's plastic waste problem? If millions upon millions of metal parts require plastic just to be formed, could our global MIM factories essentially eat our plastic pollution to build tomorrow's titanium and steel infrastructure?
Now that is a profound thought to chew on. What if the key to clearing millions of tons of plastic from our oceans is hiding in the very furnaces that make our stainless steel? Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive and exploring the invisible magic of manufacturing. As always, keep questioning how the world around you is made. We'll catch you next time.